Today, on the exam room.
One of the things that we've learned is that physical inactivity is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. So it's considered to be one of the modifiable risk factors because we can actually modify our level of physical inactivity. We've learned that people who engage in physical activity have a reduced risk by about 50% reduced risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. The way that I think about physical activity and exercise specifically is that it's a little bit like a sledgehammer, in that it's a blunt force kind of tool to change your entire body. When you engage in physical activity, you're not just changing one molecular or cellular pathway or just changing one tissue or organ system. You're changing everything.
Welcome to the Exam Room Podcast, brought to you by the Physicians Committee. Hi, I'm the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll, raising health IQs coast to coast and around the world. Hi to the exam roomies listening in Newport News, Virginia, Loma Linda, California, and Montreal, Quebec, Canada. Wherever you are, we appreciate you helping to make the world a healthier place. This is episode 99 of season 7, number 598 overall. And today we are going to be in your head, literally. This episode is dedicated to giving you a massive brain boost as we explore the relationship between physical activity and brain health. Kirk Erickson, PhD, is a first-time guest with us who happens to be the director of translational neuroscience at Advent Health Research Institute. Clearly a very smart human being. And so what we will be doing with Dr. Erickson is breaking down the way that physical activity can significantly reduce your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease, regardless of whether or not you have been sedentary for a long time. He is going to stress that it's never too late, ever, to gain substantial benefits. And then we're also going to be getting into the mechanics of what's happening in that space between your ears, exactly how exercise can boost your brain function. And it's not exclusively cardio that we're going to be talking about, because strength training plays a role here too. The benefits that can offer will be discussed. Plus, we're going to be getting into new advancements in medicine and blood tests now that can actually predict your risk of Alzheimer's. And of course, the importance of taking fate into your own hands, regardless of genetic risk, and the significant modifying risk factors that you can take. Managing your diet, managing your lifestyle, the big advancements that can give you, instead of just relying exclusively on drugs and pharmaceuticals. The power is in your hands. The power is on your plate. But before we go any further, how about planning a sweet trip to Miami, huh? Who doesn't want to do that? That'll give you a brain boost and a whole lot of other kinds of happy. So escape the cold this March and come party with us as Dr. Will Bulsiewicz will be joining me on stage for the very first time, March 7th, ahead of Dr. Neil Barnard's Bon Voyage Bash that night. Two big events happening on one big day, the bash and the podcast. Now, tickets to Dr. Barnard's party, they're already on sale, and tickets to the podcast will be going up very, very soon. Dr. Bulsiewicz and I will be in both places, so we hope that you will be as well. So come on down to South Florida, hang out with us for a little while for a healthy night like no other. Just head over to pcrm.org/events or click the link in the episode notes for tickets, and we will see thee on March the 7th. And now, from the International Conference on Nutrition and Medicine, Dr. Kirk Erickson joins us for a brain boost on the exam room. Thanks for being here, my friend.
Great, thank you so much.
What exactly does the Director of Translational Neuroscience do? That is an interesting title.
It is. Yeah, so I'm charged with trying to build a research program at the Advent Health Research Institute located in Orlando. So it's all about how can we take our science from the lab, the bench, to the bedside? How can we apply it? How can we learn from it? And back again, how can we learn from what's happening at the bedside and do science at the bench? And so this is really what we're framing and thinking of as translational neuroscience.
Alzheimer's rates right now are increasing, aren't they?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Right. Yeah, the prevalence, unfortunately, as the population grows and gets older and older, we're seeing increased rates of Alzheimer's disease.
So how does exercise translate into a lower risk of cognitive impairment as we get older?
So one of the things that we've learned is that physical inactivity is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease and dementia more broadly. So it's considered to be one of the modifiable risk factors because we can actually modify our level of physical inactivity. So we've learned that people who engage in physical activity have a reduced risk by about 50% reduced risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. We still don't understand exactly how this works, why this works, but we do understand more and more that what's good for your heart seems to be good for your brain.
Hmm. It's interesting, we don't know how. I mean, like I'm sitting here just from, again, lay perspective. I have no credentials, no letters behind my name whatsoever. But, you know, I'm just thinking like, is it because the brain gets stimulated somehow when we exercise? Is it increased blood flow, better oxidation, all those kinds of things? I mean, I'm sure that you have gone over a million hypotheses out there. What are some of the more, I guess, prevalent hypotheses as to why this could be?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of ideas, and there's actually a good amount of evidence for a lot of them. But the way that I think about physical activity and exercise specifically is that it's a little bit like a sledgehammer, in that it's a blunt force kind of tool to change your entire body. What that means is that when you engage in physical activity, you're not just changing one molecular or cellular pathway or just changing one tissue or organ system. You're changing everything. You're affecting everything. So there's everything from glucose and insulin pathways are affected. Inflammatory pathways are affected. We know that as you exercise, your brain secretes chemicals, neurotransmitters that positively influence learning and memory and mood and other outcomes. We know that the muscles, when you move the muscles secrete certain chemicals, and these chemicals in turn influence the brain. We know that when you exercise, you change your blood pressure. And blood pressure seems to affect the brain in a negative way, high blood pressure. So all of these things kind of combined are ways in which we think exercise is influencing risk for Alzheimer's disease. But we can't point to just one thing and say, this is how this is working.
Right.
But that might be actually why it works so well and so consistently across so many populations.
Because it is more than one thing.
It's more than one pathway.
It's all working together.
Exactly.
That is really interesting to me. And how much exercise are we talking about? Does this mean that if you are, 75, you need to, maybe use that AARP card and get a gym membership discount? Mm-hmm.
This is a really important question, because in order for us to be able to prescribe exercise as medicine for the prevention of Alzheimer's disease or as a treatment if you're experiencing some memory losses, we need to know what to prescribe. How much, how frequently, what's the intensity, what type of exercise is best. And unfortunately, we still have a very poor understanding of this. Mm. We think that it has less to do with the mode of activity and more to do with the intensity at which you're active. So whether you want to jump in a pool or whether you go for a brisk walk, that might not matter as long as you're doing that activity at the intensity level that really drives the heart and gets the heart pumping. So with that in mind, we do think that the effects are bigger and stronger when you're achieving at least a moderate intensity level of exercise. Now, there's still a lot left to learn around this. We still have a very poor understanding of how much is really needed. There's a lot of questions that could be asked around this, right? So if I work during the week, I don't have much time, but I spend a lot of time exercising on the weekends, and I'm the weekend warrior.
Right.
Is that going to be sufficient? Or do I need to have some regular, frequent activity throughout the week on a regular basis for it to really be driving that effect? We don't really know. We don't have a good answer for some of these questions.
Where does that limitation come in? Is it because we aren't particularly studying that, or there are long-term studies that are underway that we just haven't finished getting the data for it? Or
kind of a combination of both, to be honest. So okay. we're waiting for a number of studies to finish and be released and published. So that's certainly one issue. But then second of all, we need more research in this area. There's so many questions. There's so many people that are asking these questions and wanting to know answers and looking for answers that aren't necessarily just pop a pill, I want a pharmaceutical. They're looking for what can I do in my daily life that doesn't require me to go out and get a medication? What can I do? And we know physical activity is good. I can recommend physical activity, and I can tell you physical activity is good. But all of these questions around how much do I need to get, unfortunately, we do a bit of hand-waving. We do have public health recommendations. Public health recommendations are a minimum of 150 minutes per week of moderate to vigorous intensity activity. And so that's really generally what we are recommending. But those public health recommendations, we don't know if they are applicable to brain outcomes, especially risk for Alzheimer's disease. So it might be that you could get less activity than 150 minutes and still reduce risk. Or it might be that you need to achieve more than 150 minutes. So this is really where we're still struggling. We still don't know exactly the answers to some of these questions.
Let me ask you this. A lot of, I guess, what frustrates people as they get older and they start to experience whatever the health ailment is. Mm-hmm. You know, they always say, well, I wish I would have done things differently when I was younger. Mm-hmm. You know, do people who are up there in their years still see benefits when they begin to exercise? Or is there a point where, well, I'm 75 and it's too late for me. I'm too far gone.
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I have people that ask me this as well when they join our studies. And one of the things that they do, they sometimes tell me, is that they say, Dr. Erickson, I have never exercised a day in my life. I think that it's too late for me. Mm. And the answer is it's never too late, actually. We bring in people, we get them active, we get them enjoying the activities that they do. And we see tremendous benefits when they start exercising. So even if you've been sedentary, even if you've been inactive, even if you've really never exercised or barely exercised a day in your life, you can still benefit even at a late life. Now, that being said, are the effects bigger and better the earlier you start? Yes, that seems to be the case. But even there, we're relying then on these retrospective reports or longitudinal observational studies that really are very difficult to do and are fairly rare.
Right.
So we do know that it does seem that starting earlier in life is better, but it's never too late to start.
Right. So maybe if you get 80% as effective as somebody who was going in their 20s and 30s, that 80% is still pretty darn good.
Still pretty darn good, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I like that a lot. What about strength training? It seems like we're talking a lot about cardiovascular type of exercising mm-hmm. here, making sure mm-hmm. that you know, get out of breath a little bit, or as my friend Dr. Gemma Newman would say, out of puff. Strength training, a lot of people wouldn't associate, you know, pumping iron with having a clear mind, but I believe research is coming out now that's showing that, yeah, muscles actually make a big difference when it comes to memory.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There's some really compelling evidence coming out that that strength training, resistance training really has a powerful effect on the brain and cognition and memory function. A lot of us started out this field primarily focusing on aerobic activity, brisk walking. Primarily. And there are several reasons for that. One is that it's the most common form of activity. Mm-hmm. So we were trying to target something that wasn't just going to be only a small group of people we're going to be able to engage in. We wanted to try to engage aerobic activity because that's really what a lot of people target. And at the same time, we were also concerned about methodologies around safety for strength training and resistance training mm-hmm. in that age group. So we want to make sure that we intentionally moved a bit slower in the resistance and training space compared to aerobic. So aerobic, I think the evidence and the data is really much more well-founded at this point for its benefits. Resistance training is coming out, and it's almost there with being much more demonstrably beneficial to brain and cognition.
Would that fall into that, at this point, you know, window of, well, you should do it X number of days? And I know, because we don't have the hard data, but would you recommend maybe just generally speaking 2 to 3 times a week, busting out the resistance bands, trying to build something up like that?
Generally around 2 days a week. Yep. Okay. And doing that resistance training, getting some of that strength training in, is going to be very beneficial.
Right. And I think it's important to note that a lot of these exercises that involve not cardio, but again, resistance training, these are things that you can do at your house. You know,
right.
Push-ups against the wall, use a chair, you know,
exactly.
If you really haven't done anything in forever. When you're doing the studies, do you, I mean, you just mentioned the patient who had never exercised a day in their life, but are you working with some patients who really are starting from scratch and maybe are in pretty rough shape sometimes?
Sometimes they are, yeah. In fact, you know, we have a lot of people that have, you know, sometimes we use treadmills. There's a lot of people who have never used a treadmill before. And so it's a little bit awkward when you first start. Mm-hmm. And you're not familiar with that pace, that regular pace, and where to put your arms and your hands and how to walk in that way, especially at a brisk pace. So yeah, I think there's some education that goes along with learning what exercise to do and what experiences that you should be expecting. Some people we have to educate around what is a good type of pain to have, a level of soreness versus a bad type of pain.
Right.
And so it's these things that we often spend quite a bit of time focusing on, especially as people first come in.
How does the benefit gained from physical activity compare to some of the medications that are on market? You know, I know that those types of pharmaceutical therapeutics are very limited. We see more and more coming out, but I'm just curious if we're able to compare the benefits here.
It's a very good question, and we're hoping to do that with some of the new research that will be coming out, both in terms of in the pharmaceutical space as well as the non-pharmaceutical space. And I don't like, I think we need to be careful putting them head to head, because they're very different types of interventions with different eligibility criteria for participation. And right, so for example, we make sure we're bringing in people who aren't already running 5 miles a day, for an example, right?
Right.
That elite older adult athlete, right? But pharmaceutical trials, they can bring in any of those or all of those people. So a lot of times the eligibility criteria, the inclusion and exclusion criteria differ. So it's sometimes difficult to make head-to-head comparisons. But I do think that it's important to examine some effect sizes. So when some of the studies that are currently ongoing come out, we'll be able to see what's the effect size of an exercise intervention like what we're doing, and how does that effect size compare generally to some of the pharmaceuticals that are out there. So we're getting closer to that. I would probably say that it's very likely that some combination might produce even bigger effects.
Do you, with your study participants, talk about nutritional interventions at all? Does that go into the exercise component?
It does often, yeah. And it depends on the type of intervention we're conducting, right? So if it's a kind of a multimodal exercise plus weight loss, or exercise plus some sort of dietary supplementation or dietary intervention, then obviously that becomes a major part of the conversation and topic. Part of the way that we think that we've speculated that exercise might work actually by influencing how it influences the brain and cognition is because of changes in body composition, actually. Mm. So those things might be potential pathways by which exercise affects the brain. We've also speculated that maybe some people, when they start exercising, they start eating differently.
Right.
And so maybe some of those changes might either be confounding or enhancing some of the patterns that we see. So there's a lot of discussion about this, a lot of excitement on this, to try to find out what the answers are.
It is pretty interesting. It's like you start to exercise and you just naturally gravitate toward what would be considered healthier foods, right? You just want to do the best for your body at that point.
But some people also, as you expend more calories, some people compensate by eating more calories as well. So right. if the driver of some of the benefits of exercise are energy expenditure, then maybe you aren't getting the benefits that you think you or that you should if you are just eating a lot more calories and kind of washing out all of the benefits of exercise. So this is where we're at. We're still trying to figure out some
of
these.
It is kind of a guessing game. I feel like every once in a while you get a piece of the puzzle that you can put down and affirm, but you don't quite know what the puzzle is going
to
be yet.
And I wish we could move faster in some of these areas to get answers. It takes time, you know.
I mean, this is a pretty complicated puzzle, to use that analogy. This is not one of those 16-piece jumbo puzzles.
Yeah,
this
no,
is like one of those like 800-piece puzzles that one by one the pieces are going there. How,
correct.
You know, how many pieces do you think we have in place at this point? 200? Maybe we're a quarter of the way there?
I think so. I think that's probably a good estimate. And I really think that what we know about the brain and exercise, I think we can be quite confident about. The brain is affected by exercise just like every other organ in the body. It's not special in this way. It's not immune to the benefits of exercise. So I think we can be very confident about that. All of these questions about the different parameters of exercise that are needed to optimize and enhance, maximize brain health, I think we still have a long ways to go there. How should these things be combined? As you mentioned, dietary factors, intellectual stimulation, other things that we're doing, our sleep behaviors, all of these things are contributing to our brain health outcomes, our brain health in late adulthood. And so how all of these things come together, like you said, into the single puzzle that we're trying to put together, that's remains the challenge.
Yeah, but you seem like it's a challenge you're up for. Like you get excited by trying to put this puzzle together, don't you?
I get very excited about this. Yeah. I love the science. I think it's really great to, you know, with every question that we answer, there's another six questions at least that come out of that answer. And it's pointing us in a direction, right? We need to follow nature's lead a bit here and figure out what it's trying to tell us. What works, what doesn't work. And sometimes when we learn what doesn't work, that's almost more important than learning what does work.
Yeah. Well, before I let you go, a couple quick things I want to ask you about. Number one, blood tests seem now to be coming online where they can predict Alzheimer's with, I believe, 90% accuracy.
There's a lot of really excellent work being done with blood-based biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease. And we are definitely in that space as well. So we've been conducting our exercise interventions and trials to better understand whether exercise or how exercise influences Alzheimer's disease pathology and some of those pathways. And so I know, I'm very confident that in the next few years, there's going to be quite a bit of work coming out in that area.
I'm just curious, last question, to get your take on what we saw recently with Dr. Dean Ornish and his research that came out. I mean, really focusing on lifestyle holistic type changes, primarily dietarily driven, really promising results there.
Very promising. And he's not alone in that space. There's a lot of interesting work going on, especially with multimodal types of interventions where you're combining dietary, physical activity. There's a lot of work and a lot of excitement. And I really want to emphasize a lot of potential.
Yeah.
We know that there's modifiable risk factors, as we talked right at the beginning, modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's disease and dementia. And by modifying those, we can alter our risk. And so this is the work that he's doing. He's been able to demonstrate that by modifying these risk factors, you can alter the not only the risk for dementia, but also as a form of potential treatment if somebody's already experiencing some decline. And I just think that there's so much excitement in these areas right now because people are not just looking at pharmaceuticals. You can't. I think if you're only looking at pharmaceuticals, you're missing a major piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so 20 years from now, if we're having this conversation, how many more pieces are filled in?
I hope almost all of it.
All right, Doc, thank you so much for your time. This has been great.
Great, thank you so much.
It's not just about how many years you live. It's about how healthy those years are. That's the difference between lifespan and health span. That's a term that was introduced to me not too terribly long ago. Health span. Because would you rather live to 100 and have all your faculties still with you, still be able and mobile and out doing things, living life to the fullest? Or would you rather spend that time laying in bed and having people tend to you and feeling sick all the time? Diet is very, very, very important. It is ultra important. But it's not 100% of the game here. Exercise and moving has great benefits as well. And I want to take a moment to dedicate this episode to my late mother-in-law, Shelby Wright, who lost her battle with Alzheimer's nearly a year ago. And it is truly a wretched, wretched disease that I would not wish on anybody. But unfortunately, we're seeing millions of people diagnosed every year and millions more, and the trends are just going up and up and up and up. And that's why it's so important that we have conversations like these here on the show. Because it's a disease just like so many others that we talk about, whether it's heart disease or cancer or diabetes. We have more power to prevent this from happening to ourselves than we give ourselves credit for. But we continue, by and large, as a society, as humans, to go through life with blinders on and take those same steps that our ancestors took, our grandparents, our parents, our brothers, our sisters, our aunts, our uncles, our cousins. And it's not just genetics that get passed down from generation to generation. It's lifestyle, eating habits, recipes. And so, of course, naturally, if you do the exact same thing that your ancestors did, that your relatives did, and they unfortunately had their life cut prematurely by one of these preventable diseases, then your odds of following in their path are, of course, high. But you can't exactly chalk that up 100% to genetics. No. Because if you inherited those unhealthy diet and lifestyle habits too, that's more damning than any gene could possibly have. You are literally loading the gun and pulling the trigger. Let's stay safe. Let's not pull that trigger. Let's be kind to ourselves. Let's treat ourselves well and just see what the future actually holds for us. Our fate is not predetermined. Our fate is only determined by the choices that we make every single day. And you can choose to eat healthier. You can choose to move more. You can choose to be active. You can choose to be happy. You can choose to be healthy because it is a choice. Nothing is predetermined. You determine the path that you take. It's like those old books that we would read as kids, Choose Your Own Adventure. You write the chapters. You write the ending. How does your story end? Hopefully, many, many, many years from now, and happily ever after. I kind of like the sound of that. So I want to thank Dr. Erickson for being here and dropping a whole lot of science on us today. Great conversation. Great conversation. Okay, let's wrap things up on a high note today, shall we? I can't think of a happier day than March 7th in Miami when Dr. Will Bolsiewicz and I are going to be on stage doing the podcast in person for the very first time in front of an audience. We would love for you to be there. Doing the show with Dr. B is just like the best for me. It is truly playtime. So come play with us. March 7th in Miami. We're going to put tickets on sale very soon, but you can secure tickets to Dr. Neil Barnard's Bon Voyage Bash that same night. We're going to be there. And as a matter of fact, it's right across the street from where we will be having the podcast. So March 7th in Miami, save the date, get your tickets. They are on sale right now for Dr. Neil Barnard's Bon Voyage Bash. We'll be there, but before the bash, we're going to be doing the podcast and we hope to see you there. So March 7th, save the date. Tickets will be on sale very, very soon. And if you want tickets to the bash, they are on sale right now. Just use that link in the episode notes or head over to pcrm.org/events. And also, while you're on our website, If you want to click up at the top where it says Health Topics, one of the options is Alzheimer's disease. And right there, you can get all kinds of information that we didn't get an opportunity to discuss here on the show today for lowering your risk. A lot of stuff in there about nutrition that I think that you will find fascinating. So go ahead and check that out as well. And now through December 31st, if you would like to help us continue our life-saving mission, dollar for dollar, all donations to the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine will be matched up to $250,000. That is amazing, which means a $1 gift automatically becomes two. Your $5 gift automatically becomes 10. 10 becomes 20, 20 becomes 40, and so on and so on. So if you head over to PCRM.org and click Give Now right at the top, all gifts are matched through December 31st. And for today, that is going to wrap things up. I want to say thank you one more time to Dr. Kirk Erickson for being here as we continue to raise our health IQs. And for everyone at the Physicians Committee, I am the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll. Thank you so very much for listening. And remember, as always, keep it plant-based.